thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
I'm lifting my wing to go over these trees. We're pulling 6 Gs. I line up on the MIG, got a solid tone, squeeze the trigger. The Sidewinder comes back in, and right at the last minute, it kind of turns left, goes right up the tailpipe. Big boom. 2 pieces of MIG 21 come out of the front and slam right into the ground.
Sam Watson, broken at 405. Go!
Hello and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. I am your host, Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello. And joining me today in the Circle Air Group Studios here at Gillespie Field in San Diego, California, is Mr. Kurt Dose. Dozo, as he's known, is credited with an air-to-air victory over a MiG-21 in Vietnam. He's part of the only father-son duo to each be credited with air-to-air victories. He was a Top Gun graduate, an early test pilot of the F-14 Tomcat, and so much more, as we'll uncover here, I hope, in the next hour or so. Dozo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So glad to have you, and I really look forward to unpacking all this, like I said, because you've had some pretty amazing experiences.
It's been quite a career in a historic time, so I think I got lucky.
Okay, well, I hear that a lot on this show, so I'll let you have one of those, but not too many. Well, let's start with, who is Robert Dose?
Robert Dose was my father. Okay. This is a very distinguished dad. He won World War II, I won Vietnam, is the way my grandkids put it. But he started off in biplane torpedo airplanes with 3 people in them, and was in San Diego in 1942 and met up with Jumpin' Joe Clifton and talked him into letting him transition to the F4U Corsair. So somebody showed him how to start it, and then he just had to get his 35 hours before the ship departed 2 days later. And he actually went out with the Corsair, and then they decided that they didn't want the Corsair aboard the ship, so they dropped the Corsairs off it with the Marines on the islands and sent them F-6s. And so they flew Hellcats through the South Pacific. He later, much later, he made the first mirror landing on a Navy ship in VX-3, flying the FJ, and then flew the F-8, which he liked tremendously. He was the first one to punch out of an F-8 following a gun ingestion problem. Ended up parachuting into the water off of Atlantic City in January. Very close call there. But this was me growing up, was Dad doing these things. They tasked him to fly from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, carrier to carrier with 2 F-8s, flew supersonic most of the time across the United States, hit a Savage over Dallas, then climbed back up to 43,000 feet and came down and met President Eisenhower, was aboard ship to kind of demonstrate what the Navy F-8 could do. Pretty impressive. I grew up on Navy bases. That's, what we did. We just kind of went from East Coast to West Coast, East Coast to West Coast. I had 3 different high schools and 6 different elementary schools, and I just kind of got used to that. Always airplanes in the air and the sound of freedom, and I was pretty sure I wanted to go aviation. My father was not for this, actually. He thought that the time for being exposed to flak sites and missile batteries, don't do it in an airplane, do it where you can hide someplace. So he thought I should go submarines. And I actually have a nuclear science degree from the Naval Academy, but I changed when we went and flew the airplanes down in Pensacola. I just loved the feeling. I had done some flying, but I hadn't flown jets before, and they put us in T2 Buckeyes and just was magical when it lifted into the air.
I'll bet. It was in your blood and in your DNA from such a young age. But I just find it so funny that today, to fly a new airplane and get what we would call a NATOPS check, I don't know if you called it that then, it's like a six-month process. You know, you get the orders, go to the simulators, get the lectures, do some self-study on the computer, and then maybe go fly a few times. But, oh, here's a Corsair, and oh, by the way, you're getting on a boat in 30 hours. I mean, I can't even imagine when he did his CQ, but... And then, oh, here's a new airplane in the middle of deployment. And you said something about a mirror landing. Can you explain that? I think I know what you're talking about, but just to be sure.
Yeah, he was the first one to make a landing using the British Fresnel lens kind of landing. I think it was still a Fresnel lens, but the glide slope bounced off the mirror and it gave you a 3.5-degree glide slope all the way to touchdown. And before that, they were just doing it with paddles out there with his,
that's right.
You know, up and down and left and
cut
right.
And, all.
And a big cut. Yeah.
That's why LSOs to this day are called paddles. Was there one of those systems where it was, no kidding, a reflection of your actual aircraft? Like there was a reference and then you saw yourself above or below? I thought,
don't think so. I think you just saw, we have the lens that goes up and down and changes colors, hopefully not.
Oh, I've seen some red.
But this was just a big mirror, and it had a lens that shot 3.5 degrees up the glide slope. So
I've been trying to corral some LSOs into this studio so we can talk about not only the history of paddles and landing on ships, but also the future with this magic carpet. I don't know how much you keep in touch, but apparently it takes a lot of the thrill and danger out of it, which could be good, but that's for another day. Tell me, though, how on earth, I mean, we can't spend too much time on this, but I would think the Naval Academy would want some bang for the buck if you had a nuke degree. I'm surprised they let you out of it.
Well, I did get to talk to Rickover.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Admiral Rickover.
Yeah.
But, father of the modern nuclear Navy or whatever we call it. Yeah.
But I was pretty set, and I had good enough grades to select the service that I wanted. So I wanted to go fighters and got myself a date in Pensacola 2 weeks after we graduated.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
It was time to get going.
I have some young people that are fans of the show and are waiting, I think, something like 18 months now from commissioning to starting, because I don't know if it's Top Gun Maverick or just the way the world is, but it's taking them some time. Now, before we focus the rest of this time on you, I did mention that you're part of a duo, the father-son aerial victories. Tell us about your father's, how many, what the circumstances, and...
Dad got one or two, depending on where you read.
Okay.
And so I'm still catching up. He did shoot down a Zero. He was very proud that his air wing never lost an airplane to enemy fighters. We didn't ever talk that much about this. This is one of my regrets in life is not peeling back the onion, you know, get him cornered and have him talk more. I've learned quite a lot by looking at his logbooks. It's very interesting, the difference between the way they fought World War II and the way we fought Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They would go in and do 2 or 3 days of high-intensity flying, and then as soon as the Seabees got the runway cleared, they'd be landing on the islands and sleeping ashore, compared to our Vietnam experience where you would do 3 solid weeks of pounding into North Vietnam and stop for funerals and take 2 days off and then right back at it again. And so... it was what we were used to. It's what he's used to. He was a good officer. He later was a skipper of the Midway. I see his plaque when I tour the Midway. I say, hi, Dad. Unfortunately, he died 15 years ago.
Well, rest his soul. Sounds like he left quite a legacy, and you wanted to follow in his footsteps. So you said you flew the T-2. Now, I flew the T-2C with the two engines. Is that what was already around by then? Or
I flew them all.
You flew them all, A, B, and C?
Yeah, we had A,
because
B,
some
and
had single C's. Engine, right?
Yes,
a
the, B, a, the A had the a, single okay. engine. The B had two engines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was the A underpowered, dare I ask? Because the C
in my when you press the throttle forward, it went fast, it was a good airplane.
Good. All right. So we skipped over a little bit of detail. You, I think, enrolled in the Navy Reserve in high school and were accepted into the academy. We know how that went, accepted to flight school. That's great. But when you finished flight school, you didn't do what a lot of people do and go straight to the fleet. You did what some people do and stuck around.
They had a program called SIRGRAD that I went to, I flew the T-34, the T-2, and then, the Cougar. And then we flew the Cougar aboard the boat. So I finished, I did my whole flight training in 13 months coming out of the Naval Academy. And when I got ready to get assignments, and I was, you know, number one, doing great, and they said, you've done so well that we're going to plow you back in VT-21 for a year. And then when you get done with your year, then you can have any airplane you want. I didn't want to do that. I figured I'd be the only JG in the Navy without Vietnam experience. As it turns out, this was pretty valuable training. There's nothing like teaching something to learn how to do it. So we started off in the Cougar, single-seater and the dual-seat Cougars. And then when they brought the TA-4J online, VT-21 was the first airplane to get it. Okay. So again, quick checkout.
Yeah.
We would do checkouts in 3 days kind of thing, and then you're flying both airplanes. And these were good training and had a gun, and it was excellent. So,
what year was it you finished flight school and were?
69, I finished flight school. And
so the war was raging.
Yes.
And you wanted to, not that you're, I'm guessing, if I may speak for you, a warmonger, but hey, there's something going on. I'd like to test my mettle and go do my part. I don't want to be the one guy at the party who has to say, oh yeah, I was home training. So you had some desire to do that. But they kept you as, you said, SIRGRAD. I think that's selectively retained graduate, because you had done well and you wanted to teach, well, they wanted you to teach other students coming along. So you do that for a year. And then what happens?
And then I went to Miramar, and I was selected for F-4s and was assigned as a replacement pilot for VF-92, which was online on America. Again, a very pretty quick checkout in the F-4. I think it was like 6 weeks. And then was told to report to America, and so I flew out there with my best man, Bill Townsend. So we flew out on Continental and landed at Clark, and then made our way, went down to QB Point, and nothing was happening there. So we had to go to Da Nang and get a ride out to the ship from Da Nang. And we're on the whatever the Air Force was flying, something with two props on it, and it flew us back to Da Nang. And they had customs forms. And the customs forms said, did you bring $3,000 of money, or, you know, what, do you have any drugs? And I actually had my flight gear with me. So I did have drugs. I had
like part of the first aid kit or something?
And yeah. Okay. I had this full survival kit.
And you answered honestly?
I did. Nobody told me differently. So I did. Yes, I got those. I've got some of that.
Dear.
Yeah, I got that. I've got a pistol. Yeah, we're all set. Well, they met me at the airplane and hauled me off to spend the night in jail as they're getting this down. And the next morning, he comes in with a letter, and it's from the CO of VF-92 that says, oh, thank God you got that guy. We've been trying to nail him for years. Would you please box up all of that evidence and put it in a bag, and we're sending a C-1 in, and we'll pick him up.
That's right. We want to deal with it here.
We'll deal with him. We're going to get him good. So I went to the ship with that knowledge, knowing that this is the way I'm going to meet the skipper. We landed there in flight ops off of North Vietnam on America. Landed, somebody came and picked up my bags and took me to the ready room. The skipper was laying in the back of the ready room, and I'm all ready. I've got two or three different approaches that I'm liable to take on this.
Yeah.
And I started to say, I'm sorry, I'm a little late. And he said, no, never mind that. How are you feeling? I said, well, I feel great. And he said, well, I'd like you to fly my wing. We're going to do a vigilante escort into North Vietnam in 3 hours. Like today, yes.
Oh,
so they introduced me to my Rio, and we went to the pair loft and got another funny little pistol that we shot the flares out of, and got everything signed out, and we got the briefing from the skipper, we got the briefing from the RA-5C, and then went to the flight deck. And this is what we trained for. Wow. This is what 121 was training us to be, mm-hmm. walking across, ducking under airplanes, stepping over bombs, and finally find your airplane. It looked like F-4s that I had been flying for 6 weeks, so this must be the way we do it. So introduced me to the plane captain, and we pre-flighted it and climbed in, and pretty soon two of them were turning, and off we go.
It's amazing to me because the Navy and maybe society larger is just so risk averse these days. You know, everything is, oh, you got to acclimate to the new time zone, and to a point, right? I get it. But this was war, and you're a needed young pilot, and you're fresh. Like you said, you'd been trained. It's not like you didn't know what you were doing. And you brought your helmet with you. Is that the very helmet over your right shoulder there
that
you wore at VFA 92?
Yes.
Is that, I'm going to probably embarrass myself, is that the squadron that was the Blue Angels became that or something? Or is that a different one?
I thought the Blue Angels had
to disband. At any rate, so that was mission number one. Now, when is this? What year are we, or in month maybe even?
This is July or August, I guess, of 69.
Okay,
yes.
Wow. All right. So this is deployment number one, mission number one. And what happens? Are you comfortable, or is it kind of scary?
I should have been a lot more scared. I launched off. Everything was fine. Climbed up, found the tanker, joined on the tanker's wing. Skipper pulled off, and I went in and got 4,000 pounds. And then the Vigie took us in through South Vietnam, up through Laos, and then we entered Magia Pass and dropped it down to about 10,000 feet. The weather was pretty nice. It was clear, but as we started getting close to the target, I'm trying to write down notes on my kneeboard card so I can, you know, that I saw a truck here and that looked like a missile site and whatever. And every time I'd look up at the vigilante, he got harder and harder to see. As we approached the target, there were clouds developing around between myself. I was on the right wing and Skipper was on the left. And fighter wing, you were, you know, half mile back kind of thing. And it was to the point where I couldn't even see the RA-5. I just was flying down the runway now. And the skipper calls up and says, kite 2, break left. And so I went left. And I felt bad because I thought that maybe I was out of position and that this was, you don't want the skipper coming up and telling you how to fly formation. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and then we joined up, and as we're coming back out, the RA-5C says, Kite 2, you've got the lead. Let me check you over. And I went, okay. So the big vigilante, he's going, poking around underneath and looking. He says, oh, you look all right. I said, okay, Kite 1, you've got the lead. I'll check you over. Just because that's obviously what you do in combat. Mm-hmm. So went and checked him. He was fine, and we came in and broke and landed. I've got my kneeboard card. I'm all ready. And we head to IOIC, and the vigilante is doing the debrief, and he's talking about coming into the target area that we get heavy flak, and that Kite 2 had two SAMs shot at him, but he managed to avoid both of them nicely. And I'm looking over at Jack Wood, my Rio, and I said, they shoot SAMs at us. He said, yeah, and all the warnings, all the singer high, singer low, all of that stuff was just pure textbook. And by the way, your brake turn was beautiful, and you just shook that guy right off of us. And I went, holy crap. And so this was the first mission, and
wow.
So I should have been dead. 300 missions later, I was a little more under control, and we did see these things. But I don't know how you simulate that. We have the cubic system, I can't remember what the name of it is, but the missiles on the airplane, and you go to Yuma, and there's
like an electronic range or
something
like that.
Yeah, an electronic range that's starts putting you into a war environment mm-hmm. when they're not really shooting at you, but you can feel like they are.
Right.
And that was important. You can see why you lose people on their first 10 flights.
Well, so. They try to now simulate those first 10 flights, like you said, at different ranges or exercises for the Navy up in Fallon, Red Flag, and so on. Now, the Rio was talking about all the lights. Were the lights on in your cockpit, too, but you were just maybe task saturated?
Okay. Yeah,
so it took time to build some situational awareness.
Well, later on, you had, you know, one train of thought was following all the lights in the cockpit and the things that they were telling you, and another one for ICS talking to the Rio, and another one for the radio, you're talking to the mission commander, you know, weapons, and another one for guard to hear the ejections when they're going off. So you just would channel that stuff and fly the airplane. And, that's the amazing thing about flying fighters, flying Navy airplanes, is the things you can do with them is just
so true.
Unbelievable. And upside down, backwards, doesn't matter. You know, you're just doing what you need to do.
And the people you do it with, I know you will agree.
Goodness.
All right, so this is 1969. Now, about this time, we have been, dare I say, licking our wounds a little bit from our performance in Vietnam. So a captain named Ault does a report, and that report goes to the Pentagon. The Pentagon says, hey, I think it was 121, right? You need to stand up some specialized training. And so those folks go and do their thing and what we now know as Top Gun. And so when you get home from that deployment, you're selected to go, what, 1970?
Yes.
I mean, this thing has barely gotten going. You're one of the newest students. What was it like to go? And at the time, did you think it was anything more than, because, right, we go out all kinds of different training. You got to learn how to put out fires on the ship, which, you know, everyone needs to do if the ship's on fire. You go to survival school, you go to evasion and different things. So did you think much of this particular opportunity?
Absolutely. And I was thrilled to be the squadron pilot that would go to Top Gun. And when I first went through VF-121, you knew there was something going on over in the trailers on the side, but it wasn't something that everybody got to fly with. But it was still kind of the same way when I went through. They just had some office spaces that they would give you briefing on. Yeah,
yeah.
And marvelous instruction with our airplanes. You use your own airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had A-4s and F-5s, T-38s.
To act as the adversary for you to train
against. Acting as the adversary, and we would train against them. And
right.
Start off with 2v2 and then 2v4 and going on. And then you're also doing different radar and bombing missions. So we've fired the gun, we've fired missiles, and marvelous pilots that I still enjoy running into at Tailhook and whatever today. These are the legends of the F-4, mostly F-4 community. We use the F-8s more for adversary than actual. I don't know whether they ever were doing F-8s in Top Gun. I think they just were doing F-4s.
I think they were incorporated a little bit later, but they had their own like gunnery school and type of weapon school type thing, as I recall. So,
and this was part of Miramar. Mm-hmm. You had the F-4s on one side of the base and the F-8s on the other side, and it was a hoot. there was, you talk about a wartime footing, there was a free-for-all Friday afternoon off Whiskey 291. And
that's the warning area off the coast.
And you would just dive into that, and it was Katie bar the door. Anything.
So whoever showed up, just dogfight with what you see.
Yes,
huh?
Exactly.
Oh,
and you'd see crazy things. And even the Air Force would heard about it and start
fly over from Nellis.
Get some F-100s and, or I'm sorry, a Delta Dart, whatever that.
102 or
102,
6. 102,
I
always
think.
Forget
yeah.
those two.
Yeah.
Delta Dagger and Delta Dart.
Yeah. So they'd come in.
So they'd swing over and show up and just
get
in the fray. My goodness. That's probably good training. I mean, it's a little reckless by, again, today's standards, but it's good to just, there's something, and you can pick up the different angles and see what you see. So Top Gun, did you feel you learned a lot at that? I mean, because,
It was tremendous, and great instructors and good things to carry back to the squadron. And then we would do a little workup with the Top Gun instructors and just three or four flights kind of thing that, that they would mix, show us some of the things that they're working on. But then it was mostly just me as a weapons training officer to try and convey these thoughts that we were doing, that you don't hard turn with a MiG-17 and that gun sights take 4 seconds to settle and MiG-17 has a slow rate of roll. Things that were important to us to know when we got involved with a MiG activity.
Yeah. Top Gun was relatively new, so I think they called it the power projection. So you were really the classic candidate for this. You'd been out on a deployment, flown, you said 300 total, so I'm guessing, what, maybe 100 or so on that first deployment.
Yeah, yeah.
Came home with some experience, but now you can get the PhD level, in a sense, right there at home, and then you go back out and deploy, what, in 71, 72?
71, 72 in the Constellation.
Okay. Same with VF-92 again?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you are now the tactics officer, Top Gun graduate in your squadron, and when you show back up off of, I guess, what was it, Yankee Station, I think they called it, right? Is this when, I think, Operation Linebacker 2 is starting to kick off? So
yes.
A little bit of force to the punch now. And so what happens on this second deployment? I'm building up to May 10th of 1972 in this book we have on the table here.
Yeah, we shouldn't even have been there. Yeah, so on the second deployment on Constellation, we deployed out of San Diego and went right to Dixie Station to kind of warm up as you, you know, try some South Vietnamese tactics. And the Linebacker 2 didn't happen for about 5 months that we were there. And things got real serious. We started mining harbors and the B-52s started going into North Vietnam. And we would actually escort the B-52s in and take on the SAM sites with rock eyes and try and take them out. And the MiG activity picked up. So we had been, most of the crews, the A-7s had trouble dropping bombs. There something was wrong with them. So we were doing the bomb dropping also, so carrying 6 Mark 82s in and doing bomb dropping stuff. I mean, it wasn't that tough. I think everyone I dropped hit the ground, so that was
hopefully near the enemy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And this was it was difficult times. This was pretty heavy stuff. You going into places in North Vietnam that you probably lost an airplane or two the day before, and so you know that they're real serious. And extra attention down in IYC trying to plan your missions and find a successful way to get in there.
You said that earlier. Is that like the intelligence center on the ship? I think they call it Civic now.
I don't remember.
I'll
what
have to look it up.
Yeah.
But it's the place you go to get your intelligence before and then debrief after, hey, I saw this or this shot at me or this indication.
Exactly.
And so during this time, I have to think, and I'm not trying to necessarily celebrate this, but you talked about some of the challenges and the pain of doing this. I have to think you either saw or definitely knew of folks that were shot down. In some cases, maybe you didn't see a shoot or you did and figured they were going to be joining a long list of other people with poor treatment at the hands of the enemy. But that had to weigh on you a little bit. Was that kind of a scary, every mission, it could be you?
No, you were aware of that possibility. Mm-hmm. I came as a replacement pilot. That's how I
because
got to the squadron,
because
somebody had been shot down.
Wow.
Yeah, so it did wear on you. I always, the F-4s, I'm sure you were doing the same thing. When we'd land, they'd put us up on the bow on the port side, and they'd be safing the missiles and getting everything ready. And then so you park, and then I knew I couldn't climb down the side of the F-4 without fallen onto the steel flight deck,
because
so I would take some extra time. I'd be sorting my charts and putting things away, and I felt a little bit bad about that until I would look up the whole port side of the bow, and all the Rio canopies are open and all the pilot canopies are still closed.
They're gathering themselves.
And everybody's gathering up and trying to get all of this back in your head.
Because, but your legs were wobbly, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. The legs are doing this, and it's just we would dive into places. They'd use the Falcon codes to talk to these facts that say, okay, take out that gun that's down there at the base of the hill, and this thing's lobbing 23s and 37s up at you, kind of thing. And you dive on that kind of stuff, and this stuff's just going right by your head. It just doesn't seem possible that it misses you. They're shooting at you. That's the whole point. And so that and the SAMs, we'd get 4 SAMs shot at us every attack. I mean, that each kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you've got the bar cap and the mid cap and the tar cap, and everybody's doing their own surviving against SA-2s, which come up on a booster and then get into the second stage, is mm-hmm. doing about Mach 3 and coming at you, and you watch them coming up, and you want to find out whether they're on you or not, so you give the airplane a little negative G, and if the missile turns, then it's on you. If it doesn't turn, then you're looking to see who's going to get this thing,
because
it's coming up, mm-hmm. and you try. But then you go into a brake maneuver that shakes down, but it knocks you down 5,000 feet because you're trying to keep your speed. And then here comes another one. Now you're at 7,000 feet, and now suddenly you're at 2,000 feet, and all the AAA is coming up. So that's why your knees shake when you get back.
Wow.
The naval aircraft carrier is just a remarkable vehicle for exerting force against somebody that you want to influence. Mm-hmm. There's lots to...
It has a lot of capacity.
A lot of capacity, yes.
I never had anything remotely close to that dozo. The only time my legs ever gave me some struggle was after a particularly difficult night of landing and the ship was pitching. It was dark and everything else. But that pales in comparison. That was just me doing it to myself, not getting shot at. So God bless you and all the people who dealt with that. And day in, day out, right? Again, it's like, okay, it's not a one-time thing. You're going to go out and do it again. Maybe, did you ever fly more than one mission in a day, or was that pretty common?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Quite often.
Really? Okay. Wow.
And then you'd be doing Alert 5 during your time off. So in the middle of the night, you're sleeping up in the cockpit with a pillow.
In case they decide to come out, which was pretty rare, right? Did those ever get launched?
No, they did. Probably, once a month kind of thing.
Okay. Or for a threat or to go respond to something?
Just to respond to something, to take a look at something coming out.
All right. Well, let's lead up to, if you're willing, May 10th of 1972. And that date sticks out in my mind. I think there was a lot of activity that day.
It was the bloodiest day of the war. This was the most MiG kills, most losses during any day.
Wow.
And so we started off as the first Alpha strike from Constellation. There were 5 carriers online. And I was a MiG cap, 2 F-4s, Austin Hawkins, Jay Tinker, Jim McDivitt in my back seat, and me. And we launched, I think, 40 airplanes on this first Alpha strike.
Wow. From one carrier?
Yes.
Wow.
So Alpha strike operations, if you're... this is the difference between cyclic operations, where we'd generally run about 7 missions, mm-hmm. and then when you're just doing normal strike into Vietnam kind of thing, the first flight would launch, the second flight would man up, then they'd launch, then the first flight would land, and you'd just cycle through, and you do about 7 cycles. During Alpha strikes, you launch everything 3 times a day kind of thing.
So it all goes, it all comes back, gets turned.
Anything that's ready to fly goes up again.
Right.
And so we had been working on Haiphong and Hanoi. We were pretty familiar with it. We'd been there before. So we launched off, got 3,000 pounds off the tankers, and then all got into formation and headed towards North Vietnam. Came in the coast. Hawkins was the flight lead. He took us north of Haiphong, kind of set us up right over a top of a 100-millimeter battery that was pounding these big black fur ball things at us. And so we moved a little bit farther west, and got clear, and we're watching the strikes come in, and they've got good secondaries going off of this petroleum storage area, and they're calling feet wet, as they come off the target. And So as the last airplane's coming off the target, we're going to just go ahead and clear the area.
Close
one more
the door
time
behind them kind of thing.
Red Crown comes up and says, bandits, bandits, blue bandits, 040 at 25. Well, that meant that was from Bullseye, 040-25 was Kep Airfield.
Bearing in distance and from so a known point.
Mm-hmm. We knew that, and we knew that they were MiG-21s airborne. So Austin keys the mic and says, Kite 300, we've got that mission.
Dibs.
And immediately punches one negative G, and we start down because we really didn't want anybody to call us and tell us to come back. So this had a little bit of pre-planning on this, but okay. This is what we had been looking for. And we were the right people. We were the MGCAP. We were the ones that would protect against this threat.
Sure, you had the mindset, you had the loadout, and it sounds like the position.
We got four Sparrows, four Sidewinders.
Each.
Each,
yeah,
yes.
That's a lot. Okay.
So we descend down to about 10,000 feet. We're coming into the downwind on Kep Airfield, single runway with a bunch of riveted MiG-17s along the runway. And I'm looking down, and I can see two MiG-21s holding short of the runway, going the other way. And I'm trying to run through my strategy on how maybe I can swing around and hit one of these MiG-21s right where they sit, which would have been a terrible violation of the rules of engagement.
And not very sporting either.
It was something that what I was thinking about. And about that time, my Rio, Jim, shouts out, MiG-21's on the roll. And I looked back on the runway, and the runway was blacktop and then concrete, blacktop, concrete. And these things were sitting on the blacktop now, and they were just obvious as heck that here's two MiG-21s doing a section takeoff. I was in the best position. I called Kite 2's got the lead, burner now, in-place port, descending. And so we just did a in-place turn, dove into about a 40-degree descent. We were already doing about 500 knots. It was too late to punch the tanks off because they had a lower setting. So we just went down, and the intent was to roll out and come down the runway right after the MiG-21s and maybe get them right when their gear's coming up if we could. It didn't quite work out that well, but it might have. During the descent in this humid air, the F-4 filled the cockpit full of smoke. So I'm sitting here. I've leveled off at about 50 feet. We're doing 1.2. I've got Sidewinders growling in my ear. And I know there's a control tower up here, and I've got to miss that thing. So I reach down and dump the cabin pressurization, and that clears the air out. So everything.
Not smoke, but condensation,
condensation,
like a little cloud
inside. Yeah. And here, you know, we're looking at two MiG-21s. And so I tell Hawk that I'll take the one on the right. You've got the one on the left. About that time, they go into a break. They drop their tanks, hit the grass, and fire is going on up there.
Because they're full of fuel, they just took off.
We're going through trees down, you know, again, at 50 or 25 feet. I'm lifting my wing to go over these trees, and we're going into a lag pursuit position because they're turning tighter than we are, and we want to get to a deep 6 o'clock. So that worked out well, and I'm about a half a mile behind them, and I start pulling in, and I line up on the MiG, got a solid tone, squeeze the trigger. About 20 minutes later, the missile finally comes off the wing.
That's time compression.
Yeah, this is. Yeah. It actually takes about half a second, but it seems like that. So the Sidewinder comes off and immediately takes this gigantic turn to the left, and I'm looking at that. The missile's right there. That's the MiG. It's going over here. And I said, well, that one's kind of stupid. And I actually stepped to the next Sidewinder, and I was going to shoot another one. And about that time, the Sidewinder comes roaring back into the fight. And it's shooting for a lead pursuit position where it knows where it's going to get to the MiG, and the Sidewinder will be at the same place. So it did that, went right behind the Sidewinder, blew up, and put a bunch of dust on the hill that we were going through. So I pulled back in again and lined up. This time I was ready for it. I shot, then came off, went, whoa, right back in. We're pulling six Gs. And the sidewinder comes back in, and right at the last minute, it kind of turns left, goes right up the tailpipe. One potato, two potato, big boom. Two pieces of MiG-21 come out of the front and slam right into the ground. So then, now I'm looking at the other one. Hawk has shot a couple missiles at it, and it's not working. These were AIM-9Ds, and they just didn't have the combat fusing for managing this last turn, unfortunately. But it's the best thing we had. I talked to Jim, was trying to lock him up, shoot a Sparrow at him and at low altitude in a chase situation. We just didn't have that situation. So I pulled back in, and I shot a sidewinder at the lead MiG, and it did the same thing, went right off after it. So then I mean, I'd had my better luck on the second sidewinder on the first one, so I figured that this is good to be. It happens to be Hawk's MiG, but what the heck, a thing's sitting here right in front of me. And so I thought that I shot a final sidewinder. Turns out when I got back to the carrier that I still had a sidewinder on board. The guidance control had fired, but the missile didn't work. So that's a different story. So by this time, I'm out of sidewinders, and I'm rendezvousing on this MiG. And so I decided that I would shoot a Sparrow at it just to try and get it to turn around. So I'm probably 300 feet away from the guy at this point. I can see his little burner cans and watch his little flaps moving and all of this. So I pulled up into the vertical so I could do a Bailiron roll attack coming around on the other side. And when I got here, I'm doing my normal look around and spot two MiG-21s that are coming in from our 5 o'clock. So I called Hawk and I said, we get two more MiG-21s, 5 o'clock. And
maybe those two you saw at the Holt short.
Yeah, maybe so. No, actually, I met those guys later.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that.
So we broke port and went past these guys, went whistling by. These are all, by the way, bright silver MiG-21s, and they all have red Soviet markings.
Really?
Not Vietnamese markings. Interesting. I remember having that conversation with myself earlier when I thought, this thing's got Soviet markings, but he's in our airspace.
There you go.
So I guess we're okay.
Yeah.
We broke left. We accelerated back up to supersonic. We're doing 1.1, 1.15. And we're feeling pretty good because we know that the MiG-21s can't do supersonic below 10,000 feet.
And you think.
So we're just doing combat spread, you know, half mile apart. Jim McDivitt, again, the good Rio, says, MiG-21 coming up behind Kite 1. And look, and there's just a MiG-21 sailing. I've had to be doing 1.3, 1.4. And this was the brand new. They had not seen this MiG. And I think that's these MiGs are being delivered to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And so it turns out when we talked, the intelligence officers after this flight kept asking me if I knew and if I knew and if I knew. And I never did know. But I finally found out that the 3 and 4 MiGs, when they came through, were speaking Russian to each other. So this was these airplanes that they fly around off the beach, listening in on these conversations. At any rate, so he fires a missile. I've called for a break turn, and we cross over each other, and this missile comes sailing by me and goes off right under Kite 1, shakes him up a little bit, knocks out his radios. I, meanwhile, have come back in, and I'm on this MiG again. And Jim McDivitt, God bless these Rios, says, Kurt, what's your plan? We don't have any sidewinders left.
And no gun.
I'm not getting any. Oh, with a gun, I would have killed him. I mean, it would have been so easy. So I said, you're right. So I pulled back around, and as we came around, we're looking for Kite 2, and we don't see him.
Kite 1?
Looking for Kite 1.
Yeah, yeah.
And And that's a very uncomfortable situation.
Yes.
It doesn't do us any good to go back. So we're heading for the coast, and we're still at about 100 feet. And then there's some karst ridges right next to the coast. And as we pulled up, he was on the other side of the ridge, and we were still in formation as we launched out of there.
Oh, my.
A3 came out and refueled us on our way. I think we could have made the boat, but that was comforting.
Yes.
And we landed, and one of these Hollywood moments, with all the victory on the flight deck, it was very good. And as I say, when I get out of the airplane, I'm looking back at that Sidewinder that's still sitting on station two and going, what's he doing there?
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, callsign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
They got us down to IOIC, and they say, was this a Waterloo yellow? Was this, what happened? And we say, I don't know, just a couple MiG-20, four MiG-21s, two other ones holding short. Seemed like a good fight to us. And it turned out that they had moved a lot of the MiG-21s and MiG-17s forward, and this turned out to be just an amazing day for
a lot of aerial
Marine Corps
victories,
Air Force, turned out to be very nice.
Wow. That must have been an amazing feeling, right? You're trained to do this, and again, nobody wants to necessarily take a life, but this is what we do as warriors, and to do it in an aircraft is rare, but to do it as the son of someone who did it in World War II is rare. In fact, you're the only duo, as we talked about. What was that like? Communications were difficult between ship and shore back then, but were you able to make a call or send a letter, or how did your dad find out, and what was that like?
Dad found out, it was 7:30 in Vietnam when this fight happened, so.
In the morning?
In the morning.
Okay.
So it was the middle of night in California, and I don't know whether it was a telegram or, it was a phone call. Yeah, so somebody phoned Dad. And can you imagine if you've got...
Oh, a son in combat.
Yeah, a son in combat, and you get a call in the middle of the night. This is not probably what you want. But it turned out to be your son just got a MiG-21, and so that made that
proud
all right.
Dad moment, I wonder if he slept anymore after that. Yeah. Wow. Okay. But that's not the end of deployment, necessarily. I mean, the war goes on till the POWs come home in February of 73. How much more did you spend on station after?
We spent another 2 months.
2 months.
Online, yeah.
And more kinetic activity, dropping bombs? And
oh, yeah. Yeah. Total.
All the whole time.
And at linebacker, too, I mean, this was serious stuff. We were beating them down. Of course, we had done that earlier. We would beat them down, use up all their SAMs, and then Kissinger would want to go talk to them in Paris.
Is when they resupply.
And then
the
they resupply, and now we've got all full missiles.
Yeah, I think the way the Vietnam conflict was executed is well documented. We don't necessarily need to make this a referendum on it, but certainly from our point of view as naval aviators, not optimal. Let's summarize it that way.
We were winning when I left.
Okay. So when you come home from that deployment, is that the end of your tour then with VF-92?
That was, yeah. Okay. I think I had another month or something that I stayed in the squadron, and then I went to test pilot school. So.
And was that something you had decided because of the challenge of it, or how did that? Obviously, I mean, they don't just, I'm guessing, recruit you necessarily unless you say you're interested, I would think.
Yeah, well, I had good grades, and that seemed like where I wanted to go. Yeah, okay. The alternative would be to go back as a RAG instructor, which would have been great too.
But sure.
As it turned out, it was just an excellent time to be at Pax River.
I'll bet.
We had the last 9-month syllabus at Test Pilot School, class 64, and they assigned me after Test Pilot School was everything you've ever imagined. They've got a whole lineup of airplanes, and you just go and fly them. There's no NATOPS, there's no anything. Sometimes you'll take a one-page question
sure.
and answer and tell me the limits on this thing, but we were flying A-4s, a little bit of everything, T-38s,
yeah.
You know, just doing your basic stuff. And then once you got out, they sent me to carrier suitability, which was just an amazing operation. And this unit had about 12 airplanes that you would take to the boat, and you'd take them and you'd fly them all. So I was flying the F-4, the F-8, the A-4, the A-6, the KA-6,
wow.
The A-3, and you just get out of one, get into the other one, and go do traps and landings. I mean, it's just was yeah. absolutely amazing.
Well, there's one more that you didn't list that was up and coming, but before we talk about that one, of all those aircraft you just listed, was there one that kind of you held your breath a little bit more, or maybe one that was, not to say you ever are complacent landing on the carrier, but one that was like, oh, that was pleasant?
Well, that would be the A3.
A3 was pleasant?
It was awful.
Oh, you held your breath on that one. Okay.
Yeah. Every time I'd come through the 90, I'd have half flaps, and then I'd roll out on final, and I'd drop the flaps to full, and this airplane would
just wander around.
Start this crazy 8-barrel roll as you're trying to come in and land on the carrier. And this is really, you know, a big airplane to get into the landing area. So that one was fun. The other ones were all, God bless the A3
yeah.
guys.
Yeah. Well, and the A4 was quite the opposite. The wingspan was so narrow, it didn't even have folding wings. So lineup maybe wasn't as big a deal. Now, were you an LSO in the fleet?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. So you were in carrier suitability. Who were your LSOs? Was it
we
fleet?
Had
you had
assigned some. LSOs okay. that were, they would work us as we were getting ready for the boat. We'd have to take each one of these airplanes and make some field carrier landing practice.
That's
just
right.
to get up to speed on them. A lot of them are kind of test airplanes. And so when I get started, as I'm taking the runway, you got to find the airspeed indicator, and you never know really where it's going to be. So there it is. Okay.
In this airplane?
Now, yeah,
oh,
on this test airplane, because yeah. they've got something else.
A clock or
yeah,
some
plastered
equipment.
All over the instrument
right.
panel.
Well, at some point, now this is what, 73, 4 time frame maybe?
Late 72.
Okay, late 72. Okay.
Yeah.
Along comes this great big new aircraft from Grumman with swept wings, sweeping wings. Of course, the F-111 went to the carrier. I think that was just a couple folks who did that.
Mm-hmm.
But here comes the F-14 Tomcat. It's going to replace the F-4. And you're involved, as I understand it, in the carrier suitability of it. And I'm told that was fairly colorful because there was a lot to do. And everything the LSOs saw made it look like a particular bird and got its nickname that way, yeah?
The F-14 was wonderful. It just, you've never... Maybe you have felt the power like that, but this, you know, we could almost accelerate going straight up. The whole concept of this swing wing airplane with the wings at 20 degrees, which let you loiter for 2 hours, and then when you get into operating, you as you accelerate, the wings go back, and you can fly a very formidable fighter mission that I went against F-15s and beat them. I mean, we could...
Oh, so you're not just landing these. You're swirling
yeah.
around a bit, too?
Yeah, we would have a chance to fight everybody, and this was a very interesting airplane. The airplanes were test airplanes, and so some of them, well, they all originally didn't have weapon systems, so you'd just flip a couple switches to bring the INSs on. They had a rear cockpit, but... wasn't hooked up to anything. I mean, it just, you could talk to it. So people would come and ride with you, but they weren't, you know, they were just having fun. But then during the next year, they would be bringing in weapon system parts. And so pretty soon you had a TAD that was in front of you that you didn't have before. And the Rio and back is working on different things. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely fascinating. You take off southbound out of Pax River, and as you lift off, this airplane with the AUG-10 would just swing back and forth and plot 37 targets all the way down to Florida. And then it would put 1 through 6, and this is what I'm going to shoot my Phoenix missiles at. And you know, it's fascinating. As an F-4 guy, you know, we had a radar, and it was pretty good, but nothing like what this thing saw.
The AUG-9.
AUG-9 was... Yeah.
So on this show before, Dozo, we've had people who have flown both the F-14 and, say, the F-18, and we've compared those two multiple times. Do me a favor and compare the F-4 and the F-14. Now, again, they're different generation to a point, and maybe even different mission to a point, but how would you compare the F-14 and the F-4?
I love them both, but I mean, the F-4 was an interceptor, started off as a bomber, actually, and got presented to the Navy, and they liked it, but it was a shake, rattle, and roll airplane. When you pulled on the G's, the airplane would be buffeting the whole time, and so we did what we needed to do to make it work. The F-14 was just sliced butter. It was just so pleasant. The early airplanes, we had some problems with them. The throttles, you kind of had to set them and don't mess with them while you're coming around. And then once you get unloaded, then you can bring the power back up, kind of thing. But there were advantages, too. The initial airplanes didn't have an aileron rudder interconnect. We could get into somebody where we'd get slow. You get down to 150 knots, kind of thing. And if you slam the stick over to one side, the airplane would rotate the other way. It would depart and start, the nose would just slide around. And then when you got it where you wanted, you pop the rudder the other way and go right back at this guy. I mean, it was an awesome thing to be able to do, but you couldn't do it too long because otherwise the airplane would go into a flat spin, which you didn't want to do. So this was a very good thing. The airplane, I mean, you just had to love it. You loved the weapon system. It had 4 and 4 Sparrows and Sidewinders and then 6 Phoenix. If you never carried that many, you'd carry 2 or 3
photo
of them.
Op, maybe.
But that was a wonderful weapon system, and you'd be shooting at people that are 80 miles away. It's just amazing.
And they built a gun back into it, which I've got a question coming up about that. But so you take it to the ship. I mean, any color trying to land aboard the ship with this thing? I understand it wasn't easy. I never flew it.
Well, to the pilot, it felt great because you're sitting out here in the point of this massive airplane behind you.
It's all
you.
Behind you, yeah.
Yeah, it's all back there, and it's doing things. And we had elevators on the F-14 are bigger than the wings on A-4.
Yeah.
They're huge. And they differential. So they're going like this. And then you've got spoilers on top of the wings that are destroying the lift. And they're popping up and down and popping up. And you're making little corrections with the glide. And so to you, you're right center glide slope. Everything's perfect. I'm coming right down. I'm going to put it right in the landing area.
Just right into the laser beam down.
I'm going to get a 3-wire. And everything's great. And the LSO would come back and think, what were you doing out there? You had stuff coming all over the, you know, this whole thing. Here's the pilot, and all this stuff's happening in the background. And so that's why we called it the turkey, because it just looked like it had feathers going up and down and everywhere. And so it was hard to get an OK-3 in an F-14. It just, you were back there. Trouble is it landed 15 knots slower than the F-4. So the F-4 come whistling in and land.
No time for a
mistake.
Land.
No time to make a mistake. And the F-14's just back there going, here I come.
My goodness.
Very safe, but it's hard to win the greenie board with the...
I always used to say, because I wasn't particularly great flying the ball anyway, was, hey, I got a board and they can use the airplane again. So you do a handful of the testing it needs to go to the fleet, and then you go to the fleet with it, right?
I go to the fleet as the second and third crews with VF-2. VF-1 and VF-2 were resurrected for the F-14. we were going back out to Vietnam. Actually, during the first cruise, they actually went to Vietnam and flew some combat sorties with the F-14.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Like maybe at the very, very end?
Yeah, at the very end, before. So we were coming back just after that, and there was a lot of interest in the F-14. You talk about Alert 5 launches, you got a lot of them because we'd get up in the North China Sea near Vladivostok and they'd come out with bisons and bears maize. And so you're on the Alert 5, bang, next thing you know, you're going to go find these guys. The interesting thing, these are huge bombers, have four rotating props, silver, red stars. We would join on them, and we had our own little set of rules that we could use. You weren't allowed to hit anybody, but you could do just about anything else. And so we'd come in with a section of two F-14s. We did this with the F-4s too. And you'd put one of them a mile back. You know, these guys are usually flying a kind of a loose-deuce spread formation. And the lead would go in and mess around with the lead bear. So you couldn't really get to the cockpit, but we could join on the tail gunner and his flight controls back there, and we'd just fly right with the tail gunner. And the Rios would usually have centerfold from Playboy to show.
International relations.
Dear. And we would just do things. The F-14 was pretty nimble. And so you'd come in and flip it on its back and just kind of join up on the tail. And then we'd stick the tail hook up and flip it over. And then we'd show them the wings back and the wings forward and just doing stuff.
Yeah.
And they would just, all the little windows on the bear would be full of people with cameras and taking up. I think one of the things, I think we used to do it with the F-4 more, but the Rio would take his helmet off and turn it around and put his oxygen mask on the back and then lean back against his instrument panel, and it would look like a rear-facing Rio. And so I keep, every time I see one of these MIG killer books or something, I keep looking for the picture of the F-4 mic that has
the rear-facing Rio. I thought you were going to say then you would turn your head in such a way that it made it look like the Rio was an Exorcist guy with his neck's turning the wrong direction or something. But that's crazy. So, right, just I think hopefully most people watching or listening are aware of the Cold War. The Soviets would come out, want to take a look at the carrier, and they were maybe even listening or snooping on the Trons. But we didn't want to let them do that without, hey, we're here too. So they'd send out their bombers and different things, and we'd join up on them. And amongst Airedales, though, it was good spirits, right? You weren't...
Well, it was more to it than that. They were trying to find the carriers normally.
Oh, okay.
And somehow finding a carrier in the North China Sea is just not that easy. And we would know that the bears are up there. We never emitted anything. You didn't have the radar or the TAC-N on.
Right.
And we would take off from the carrier. We'd go 25 miles to a vertical point where we would then climb and appear, and then we would come after the
bears. As if the ship
bears,
was maybe over
as
there.
As if the ship is over there. So then you'd see the bears heading over and looking in that area, but they just wouldn't find the carrier quite
often.
Cat and
mouse games. All right.
We did have a rule that any time they did find the carrier that we wanted to have F-14s on it. So you'd always be kind of tucked in as you flew by.
Right. So in other words, if they're going to take a picture of the carrier, they're going to have a Tomcat in the foreground or
yes.
a Phantom maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that they can't just send it to Washington or the news and say, oh, look, we found, oh, we're right there, ready to go.
Watched it the whole time.
But it sounds like, I mean, obviously you had some male humor amongst folks, but was it fairly cordial? Or, I mean,
yeah,
there's only so much yelling you can do between cockpits. But how long did you end up serving? Because I know you did the F-14 tours, but my studies couldn't find much more. Did you end up serving the full career?
I did. I just did it in the reserves. Unfortunately, when I retired, about 16 years active, they made me a commander.
Okay. Unfortunate because you didn't want
to Yeah, because
grow
I
up.
Wanted to go fly for 301, 302, and...
Which was
F-14s okay. at the reserve squadrons and F-14s.
Okay.
But if you're a commander, then you can only be the skipper, and that doesn't work that way in the reserves.
Right.
So
you left active duty, but you stayed reserve to
I
get the time
reserves,
you needed doing
yeah,
something non-flying, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. What'd you do on the outside?
I went and flew for Flying Tiger Line, and I was flying DC-8s and 747s for Flying Tiger Lines, and then in 1989, FedEx bought Flying Tiger
right.
Lines, and so then I flew the 747 for them, and then the DC-10, and then the MD-11 when it
yeah.
came out. So
I'm putting myself on the spot. We've had another gentleman in that seat who did something similar. Maybe Bob Strang. Does that name sound familiar?
He was. Does it sounds familiar? Yeah.
He was our C-7 Caribou guest. He had flown some Vietnam missions in that platform, and I think he went to Flying Tigers as well. I've done too many of these. I can't keep track of it all. When it comes to fighters, how many hours across how many, if you know, number of airplanes? I mean, it seems, sounds to me like 30 or 40, it seems like.
Yeah, that kind of numbers. I haven't actually added that up.
No?
I had about 7,000 hours.
Wow.
And
not counting the Flying Tigers?
No, that's just Navy, yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of time. How about traps?
I'm not the Centurion. I think I 800 or something
800,
like
okay.
that, yeah.
But in a lot of different aircraft. I mean,
yes.
some people, like I only ever took, well, I took the Hornet and the Super Hornet, but they're pretty similar. But you took so many different aircraft to the boat. Wow. And did you do any more flying apart from the big heavies on your own for fun? Any?
No.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to introduce you to Bones, who owns this hangar. He's got his fleet of F-5s. So bet you could jump right in and pick up where you left.
I'm ready to go now.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, I've got a couple listener questions I want to ask, but before I do, I'm glad I have my little notes here because I reminded myself of in 2016. Let's talk about that because you were part of a reconciliation tour, and we don't have to necessarily, unless you want to, get into how that came about, but you were one of them, and on my F4 episode, gosh, I don't remember what episode that was, but it was with Jack Ench and Tiger Kerr, Fingers and Tiger. They talked about being part of it as well, and I think Willie D did as well.
Yes.
He was part of it. Summarize what that reconciliation purpose was and your role in it, because you got to go back to Vietnam.
Yeah, I got a call from Charlie, who was a Marine F-4 pilot.
Was that his first name?
That's his first name, yeah.
Because Charlie was also kind of a slang term for the folks we're about to reconcile with.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember his last name.
That's okay.
I can't, it's not coming to me. So he was in contact with a Vietnamese general who was an airline pilot. They were putting together a trip to visit Hanoi. I'm sorry. And I thought that sounded like a great idea, and I could just use my airline miles to buy tickets to Hanoi. And so we went. And the idea was that we would meet the airplanes that we were fighting against us. I knew that the pilot that I shot down died, and that the flight lead on that flight had died 2 months later as one of Steve Ritchie's kills. And so I just didn't expect to find much of...
On your engagement?
On my particular engagement, but mm-hmm. there turned out to be some. It was kind of interesting. We reported to the Hanoi, had a nice hotel, and went down and met, I think there were 25 MiG pilots there, plus translators. The more we talked with them, the more we reminisced with them, you realize that they were just in exactly the same position that we were. You're just trying to keep from getting shot down.
Right.
You're trying to get the job done. And it was really interesting to learn. They would take high schoolers and send them to Moscow. And they would finish their high school and they would learn basic training. And then they'd transition them into the MiG-17 or MiG-21 and send them back to Hanoi, and they would be part of the squadron, and then they have to deal with me as they're trying to take off. And every flight of theirs was a full combat flight with terrible consequences if you screw it up. So this was interesting. And we learned things like that the MiG-17, when they ejected out of the MiG-17, it was a pretty rough ride, and they generally ended up not flying for 4 or 5 months afterwards, getting body parts back into the right place kind of thing. I was one of five, I think, MiG killers in the group, and so they had a special Vietnamese TV show where they just asked us questions and translated, and so we did one of those shows, and then the second show, the communications director for the Vietnamese TV said that the sister of the guy I shot down wanted to meet me on the TV show.
Wow. So she heard your story and said, wait, that's my brother.
Yeah. That didn't sound attractive to me. I couldn't imagine how that would work out well. But they convinced me that the Vietnamese are very forgiving and that this is worth doing. So we had another show, and we went about a half an hour, and then the MC comes up with this lady, and she's got a picture of the guy that I killed, and they look just the same. Very, very impressive. And then they had two or three MiG-17 pilots that were his buddies also. So they talked me into, they invited me to their house in South Hanoi. And so that Charlie went with me, and we went down, and we stopped in a kind of a open area and got out of the cars and met some of these family members. And it was just a bunch of head nodding and thanking. And then we went to their house and had a 5-course meal kind of thing with lots of vodka. Anybody that learns to fly in Russia drinks a lot of vodka.
Okay.
And so there was some vodka. We first went to the gravesite where he's buried.
Okay.
And we had some flowers. And this was a military cemetery. And so then back to the house, and a lovely meal, very nice. And then the communist rep that was in charge of this area that was allowing us to go and visit, we had met him first, had to stop and get permission to go to this town. And he stood up and said, this has been a great honor for you to visit us, and we are renaming the road to be Doze Nai Way in honor of your visit. And so then the head of the family, who was an uncle, stood up and said, we were very pleased when Nguyen was assigned to MiG-21s. Mm-hmm. This is the top position. And on May 10th, we lost him. But now, 30 years later, we've got a new pilot. We have an F-14 pilot, and we hope that he will come and stay with us in our house and stay in communications. And so I still do talk. I send emails back and forth every 2 or 3 months. We just exchange some. So that's nice. We had a chance to go back out to Kep Airfield. We couldn't get on the base. They had different MiG-23s or something that they're flying now. But I mentioned that when we were coming on the air into the airfield, all MiG-17s sitting in revetments alongside the runway. Well, Colonel Dow is one of these MiG-17 pilots, and he was sitting there on May 10th, and he says, I'm just sitting there watching, and I watch two MiG-21s, and they're rolling. They're just about to take off. And then all hell broke loose because we were coming in supersonic, so you couldn't hear us coming. We were, you know, faster than the speed of sound, faster than sound. Mm. And so suddenly there's just a kaboom. Can you imagine two F-4s 50 feet over the top of you? And he said at that point, you know, tanks are coming off, missile fires, airplanes, missiles in the air, and he says it's just the end of the world.
Well, and he was one that survived.
Yeah, so he was fine.
Wow. What a story, Dozo, because it speaks, I think, to the heart of humans. I mean, we can be at odds, we can war, we can do our duties. As you stated, each side was doing their duties. And in the end, it sounds like you had closure. And this family had closure. They lost their fighter pilot, and they gained you. And you keep in touch now. And that's heartwarming. And so good, I think, of Charlie to figure out a way to make this happen for the people that were involved. And then I guess, did they maybe come to America later, or was that?
They did. They came a year later.
Okay.
They came to San Diego.
Yeah.
And we had agreed to kind of host them and set it up. Mm-hmm. So we picked the Miramar Air Show weekend and took them aboard the Midway and took them out to meet the Miramar Air Show, which is just a fantastic flying exhibit. And the Blue Angels came, of course, and CL-22s and everything else. And we were staying with them, you know, had one of these party rooms up in the front kind of thing. And as the Blue Angels flew by the first time, you could see the MiG pilots are going, so close, you know. So MiGs are flying 18-inch spread on their wingtips. Yeah,
the blues. Yeah.
So it's pretty, pretty amazing.
Wow, that is a happy ending to an otherwise very ugly situation, I think, for all involved, nations and individually. So I want to transition to some listener questions I have for you. Now, these are provided by folks that support the Fighter Pilot Podcast on Patreon. And I tell them, hey, I'm going to sit down with Kurt Dose, and I send them a link or your little one-page bio there that I found. And they say, oh, I want to know this. So if you don't mind, I'll put these to you, and who asked them? Now, you already answered this one. It's from Gordon Bradbury down in Australia. Did you miss not having a gun on your F-4 over Vietnam?
At some point, the missiles will be good enough that you don't need the gun.
Mm-hmm.
The gun is a final delivery weapon system. The shooting envelope ends up being very close to what you're going for. If I look at my situation, I should have had four MiGs. I should have had at least the, you know, we only had Sparrows, so our
after you
our radar weapons wasn't that good. But it was, the Sparrow was a great weapon up and away, and if we had been taking on these MiGs head on, if I didn't have to VID them, it would have worked fine. But so the Sidewinder was a good missile, and if you look at the new AIM-9X, it's just breathtaking.
It
breaks my heart because they, when they were testing the AIM-9X, instead of a warhead, they would put a little video camera transmitter in the weapon system, and they were shooting F-4s.
Yeah.
And all of these shots of these F-4s doing one gallant final maneuver in this Sparrow. The
QF,
Sidewinder. Would,
unmanned QF-4, at least, but yes.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking,
and it just get hammered.
Yeah.
And so if my Sidewinders had worked, I wouldn't have needed a gun. As it was, I would have loved to have had one. My windscreen was full of MiG there. I could have
stitched your name.
Yeah, I could have written a name across the wing. Yeah, it's just.
But did you fly a model later with the gun? Because Tiger, who was on my F-4 episode, he said that he didn't prefer it as much just later, you know, after combat, because of, I guess it was pretty far forward and it made the performance a little less.
Well, they mounted it on the F-4E, and it has a kind of a canoe. It shrunk their weapon system down. Their radar got smaller, and they put it underneath. As far as I know, it worked on, you know, but I had it in the F-14, and I loved it on the F-14, but I had the same missiles except as the AIM-54. I think that you just got to make the missiles better. I think
getting
that point now.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you can shoot it off your wing and it goes and picks off somebody at 5 o'clock,
that's crazy.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, for sure. They have improved the weapons, but it's still the same old battle. The F-4 was designed originally without a gun. Now we've got the F-35 B and C that can have the pod, but anyway, let's not get into that. Jim Gundog says, what were the expected or unexpected benefits from your SIRGRAD assignment? in addition to instructing in a new airframe in the training command. So did you go into it thinking this is what I'll get and you got it? Or did you go into it thinking this is what I'll get and I didn't? Or you didn't think about it and you got something, you know, anyway, I'm going to get myself tied up here. But
I got told on numerous occasions that this is the best thing that can happen to you. And undoubtedly it did. I mean, it made me just a great pilot.
Because you were instructing.
Because I was instructing and teaching people how to do formation flights, how to do ACM, how to do gunnery. And so these are the skills that I took back to BF-121 and BF-92, and they were good skills, kept me alive.
Yeah. So you weren't just wet behind the ears when you got to the fleet. You had a little more experience.
Yeah, I had quite a lot. I think I had 2,000 hours.
Wow.
So it was a pretty, I mean, as a bachelor, the training command was wonderful because we would fly two or three flights a day, and then on the weekend, people needed cross-country time. So you could fly them to San Diego, fly them to Washington, whatever, and so this was good for them, but I was racking up 120 hours a month.
Oh my gosh.
And I actually got a letter from somebody that said, knock that off. You can't fly that much.
I think that's how many hours I got in my last 2 years in the Navy. So I'm a little jealous about that. All right, next question is from Michael Tenish. How difficult was it to join an existing squadron immediately after transitioning to the Phantom and fly combat missions right away? We pretty much talked about it, but you, again, were trained 6 weeks, sounds like, at BF-121, so you weren't brand new, but come on, sometimes it takes a little experience to really know, hey, this switch is over here, and this is what it feels like when I turn like that.
The interesting thing that I find out later is that the initial F-4 squadrons all came from F-3 demons, and that these F-3...
Which was also McDonnell, I believe.
The F-3 demon was just a big interceptor, no dogfighting, just get yourself 30 degrees to the other airplane. And so they were apparently looking forward to my arrival, and the Rios were bidding on who's going to fly in my back seat kind of thing. And so I look back at my best man, Bill Townsend, came from the demon. And so we were showing up together, and that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I never had any trouble. Nobody ever said no. I mean, you could do whatever you could get away with and not hurt yourself.
or bang up the airplane, hopefully.
No, you did, yeah, and you didn't want to hurt the airplane.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I've got a reunion coming up at Tailhook in 2 weeks with BF-92, and we'll have about 20 of the guys, and we've got a part of our celebration is a memorial service where we're gonna
honor the
say goodbye
lost,
to the guys that we lost, and there's a lot of them.
I will be there as well. Now, as people watch and listen to this, it's probably in the past, but I'm looking forward to making the annual trek up to Reno for Tailhook, so I'll look for you.
That's great.
And thanks very much. All right, so now I have two questions related to Top Gun, one sort of before and one after. The first is from Mike Hindle. How did your first deployment help with Top Gun? Did you think to yourself, hey, I saw what they were talking about?
I mean, that's exactly what Top Gun's talking about.
Right.
And they would always try and connect the bit of information that they're teaching, the advantage of combat spread, the advantage of singling out a particular airplane, and you get him dodging one airplane and then the other one shoots him down. We could see that, and we went up and we fought against the 102s, the Delta Wings, and if you responded to their big first move and got rid of your airspeed or, you know, slowed down, then you were toast. If you just did one more loop and came back around, he didn't have any energy left, and you could take care of him, kind of thing. Same thing we needed to do with MiG-17s. And so Top Gun curriculum was born out of fire. They needed to fix this. They were losing too many airplanes, and they, I think, really did an excellent job of putting that whole course together.
Indeed, which is a great segue into my question from Jevin. How did your training at Top Gun change your second deployment, and did it make a difference that day, May 10th, over Kep?
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything that I knew from Top Gun. I had adjusted all my previous thoughts on how you dogfight an airplane, so it was crucial.
Yeah. Last question is from Nick Forrester. To what extent did you get assistance from EC-121 Airborne Early Warning Aircraft or Red Crown in detecting MIGs? Now, you had said the words Red Crown earlier, and I let it go because I knew we had this coming. And then just as a caveat, given the small visual signature of both MiG-17 and MiG-21, depending on visual pickups, must have led to short-range engagements with little opportunity to position for the advantage of the BVR AIM-7. So we've already talked a lot about this, and let me see if I can tee this up a little bit more. You couldn't really use the AIM-7 too much in Vietnam because you had to put eyes on everything. And by the time you did that, your AIM-7 Sparrow was essentially relegated to,
inside,
okay, can't use it
range,
anymore.
Yeah.
So getting back to the beginning of his question and help us understand what Red Crown is, how valuable was that? And you've already said they told you that day, hey, there's something out there.
Red Crown is a cruiser that sits off in North Vietnam. I think it was the Oklahoma.
So this is their call sign, right?
Yeah, this is just their call sign. And so they would come up and tell us when MiGs are in the air. And so that was always nice to know. They didn't get into personal control. Somebody else would do that. Our E-2s would put us on the target and help us start off the fight in an offensive position if you could. The 121s, I don't think we talked to them. They never called me. But that's where the speakers are. I think the Russian speakers and the Vietnamese speakers would be listening in on.
So we're eavesdropping on their radios.
Yeah, we're eavesdropping, mm-hmm. And then that message traffic goes out top secret or something, too.
Well, speaking of that, one advantage I have as the host is I can ask dumb questions that I don't know, but I can pretend it's for the audience. How does the destroyer know that there are MiGs airborne? Is it because they've got radar, or are they also listening, or are they being fed that information from somewhere else? But they're off the coast a little ways.
Yeah, they do, and they got attacked a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they would be listening in on the overall frequency that, hey, you've got targets coming in. And that's, of course, what BARCAP was for. We would position ourselves between the North Vietnam and the ship to be able to handle anything coming out towards the ship. They never did try and attack a carrier, but they would go after these destroyers that are pounding away with their 5-inch guns.
And providing intel to the pilots.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I mean, this has been amazing. You mentioned this book earlier. I actually bought this book when I was at Top Gun as the MiG killer coordinator. Now they call it the combat speaker. But I've got a bunch of signatures in there, and I'd like to, if you don't mind, add yours to it, because I've met a lot of folks like you over the years, and a lot of your stories are in there. And I don't know what I'll do with this book someday, but hopefully maybe a museum will take it. I'm sure they will. But I'd like to add you to that, if I may. And what have I not asked you about that maybe I should? For example, I'm curious what your reunion was with your father. We talked about him getting the phone call in the middle of the night. Did he meet the squadron when you flew off the ship?
Yes, of course.
What was that like?
It was excellent and kind of typical. We came in with 12 airplanes into Miramar, and the skipper assigned Hawkins and I to be the solos coming in on the air show. So the whole, we had some sort of formation with with 10 airplanes, which looked good.
Sure.
And we started off behind them and came in at 50 feet, doing about 0.98 kind of thing. And as we came in underneath, as they crossed into the Miramar, we pulled up and went through the formation with two and started spitting out flares. And the flares came down and actually set the grass on fire out on the other side of the runway. So that wasn't so great, it was a spectacular show, and that worked well.
Wow. Was he still on active duty when you?
No.
Okay.
No,
when
he had retired about 3 years before.
Before that, wow. Well, what keeps you busy these days, Dozo?
I have 12 grandkids.
Wow.
And that is a wonderful There's nothing better.
Okay. And, how many here in San Diego?
Got 10 of them up in Los Angeles, wow, in Altadena, and two of them in Ames, Iowa. And that's where I was yesterday when you were trying to contact me. I was flying back from Ames, Iowa. Yeah.
And the last question we always ask on the Fighter Pilot Podcast is about call signs, because people find call signs funny and fun. And so Kurt Dose, Dozo, I mean?
Dozo, yeah. It's I had a perfectly good call sign that I was using, Scarlet, which was my father's call sign.
Oh.
And so I had done all of my flight training and, you know, the advanced training command and everything, and we were always Scarlet Flight, and that was fine. So, and when I got to 121, transitioned to the F4, nothing happened. I was still Scarlet. And then as I got to the ship, I was still Scarlet for a while, but we went to Yokosuka, and they were going to the Hotsi Baths in Yokosuka. And this is, they have kind of tubs, sort of narrow tubs that you sit in hot water, and a little girl comes in and washes you off with a, you know, all around neck and everything. And then when she gets down to your private parts, she gives you the sponge and says, "Hi, Dozo," which I didn't know what that meant, but it sort of meant wash it yourself, I think. But this is when we came, I think it means please, but when we came out of the Hotsi bath, the skipper looks around and says, "Okay, your call sign's Dozo." And that was it. There's no vote about it. You don't change anything. And it was Dozo or Hi, Dozo.
Yeah. Well, Dozo, Kurt, thank you. You've been a wonderful guest, and I'm just so amazed by your stories and your humility. Thank you. And also just the fact that, you know, there's no other, as I understand, duo in the world that where the father and son have both been victorious in air-to-air combat. So congratulations on that. But I think more than anything, I really loved the story about the reconciliation, and I'm sure that brought a lot of peace for you and definitely for their family. So thank you for sharing that as well, and for your time today and your service.
Thank you, Jello. Thanks for having me.
This episode of the Fighter Pilot Podcast is adapted from a studio interview conducted at the Circle Air Group FBO on Gillespie Field in El Cajon, California. Visit the Fighter Pilot Podcast YouTube channel to watch this episode and hundreds of other military aviation-themed videos. To learn more about the show, visit our website, fighterpilotpodcast.com. And for exclusive content, check out our Patreon page. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.